Today, it's metaphysics. It's metaphysics. Now, why are we starting here? We're starting here because this is the most all-embracing of the philosophical fields. That's one reason. Also, it's traditional to start here. And it's what most people think all of philosophy is about. And naturally, your relatives are going to want to know what you are doing here at the college, and they're going to ask you, well, what about this philosophy course? And right away, you're going to be able to tell them about that aspect of philosophy that they have in some sense heard of. And that will mean that they will become donors to the college, and more buildings will be built, and so on. All right. The term metaphysics. It comes from the Greek meta ta physika, and that translates as beyond the physical. And so everyone has thought that Aristotle, in the book that is called the Metaphysics today, was already thinking in those terms of describing the universe beyond the physical. The irony of this is that that isn't the situation at all with Aristotle or with the origin of the term. Actually, the material which is called the metaphysics of Aristotle, he didn't call that at all. He called it variously theology philosophy or wisdom, this kind of thing. Later on, when the books of Aristotle were collected together, an early commentator titled that section of the material Meta Ta Physica Biblia, classified after the physics books of Aristotle. In other words, this had nothing to do with the content. It had to do simply with the arrangement, because Aristotle also did important work in the sciences, right? However, as time went on, people looked at this stuff and they said, gosh, that would a perfectly appropriate title for it. And the term metaphysics then came to mean that which is beyond the physical. You want to be very careful with this, because the field of metaphysics doesn't exclude the physical at all. Metaphysics refers to that branch of philosophy which endeavors to understand the universe as a whole. And that, by the way, is W-H-O-L-E. Somebody caught that. That's good. It's coming along. Yes, not H-O-L-E, but universe as a whole, W-H-O-L-E. Right. It's the branch of philosophy that tries to understand the universe as a whole, its fundamental meaning and purpose. It's the field that tries to arrive at the most general truths about the universe, including the physical. And it endeavors to do this, notice, by the use of unaided human reason. Tries to do this by the use of unaided human reason. Since this kind of operation began among the Greeks in any formal sense, we're not getting into Indian philosophy, East Indian philosophy and stuff like that. Since this began really among the ancient Greeks, it occurred apart from any revelation from God. And therefore, it's an effort to make sense out of the universe through human reason. And you can hardly blame them for trying to do this, since they did not benefit from revelation at that point. Now, today, in popular parlance, the word metaphysics has other connotations. Since the time of Kant, the philosopher Kant, in the 18th century, Many people have thought of metaphysics as a speculation having to do with unanswerable questions, you know, messing around with stuff that you couldn't solve anyway, dealing with things that can't be answered through scientific investigation or experiment. Hume, the 18th century philosopher, talked about metaphysical matters as excessively subtle, you know, excessively subtle things, things that are so theoretical and abstruse that one is just not going to be able to pin them down very effectively. So you will find the term metaphysics used in that sense. And, of course, with the rise of the New Age, dingle, 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 and all of this and that, we have the term metaphysics as a synonym for occultic reasoning. Go into an occult bookstore if you can stand it, and there you will find a metaphysics section. That got nothing to do with philosophy as such. It has to do with occult insights or whatever. The biggest problem in those occult bookstores is the incense. The incense. This stuff, you know, you feel as if you ought to have brought in an airline poop bag with you because of the incense. Ghastly. And also these days, if you go into a B. Dalton's bookstore or any of the general bookstores, if you go to the occult section, you'll find metaphysics as a label. But that's not what we're talking about at all. In a sense, you can see a movement in the use of this term from efforts to understand the universe in its totality through human reason, then a slippage from this to working on stuff that's so abstruse that you're never going to get anywhere with it anyway, and then finally to the occultic use of the term, where the only way that you can obtain knowledge is through some kind of Gnostic introspection or contact with the spirits and all this and that. All right. Now, metaphysics also embraces a subfield which in many respects blends with the whole field of metaphysics. And this subfield is ontology. Ontology, O-N-T-O-L-O-G-Y, ontology. This is from the Greek participle, from the verb to be. Eimi is the verb to be in Greek, and the participle is on, ontos, on. Ontos, from ontos, ontology. Ontology is the study of being, of being. Now, you can see why this would easily blend with metaphysics, because you can regard all of the existent universe as being, as the substance of it. But there are people who concentrate solely on the question of the nature of the universe per se. What does it consist of? What is its being? Yes, and if you begin fiddling about in the area of ontology, you discover that there are strong theological connections at that point. Modern liberal theologians, at least some of them, have been very interested in ontology. Best example is Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich, his theology is called an ontological theology. Tillich defined God as being itself, being itself, or the ground of all being. Some theological students were unpleasant enough to call that the hamburger God, the ground of all being. Yes, yes. there are serious problems with trying to develop a theology from the concept of being. Some very serious problems. And I've done a critique of Tillich in my book, Where is History Going? And you might be interested in taking a look at that at some point, as to the problems that arise when you try to work a theology from being instead of from a revelational source. Now, in a very real sense, every great philosopher has his own metaphysic, and we are hardly going to be able to run through them all in the course of a lecture. What we want to do is to illustrate how metaphysical operations take place, and we're going to do this by taking three classic examples of metaphysical thinking. We're going to say a little bit about Hegel. We're going to say a little bit about Marx. And we're going to talk about existentialism. Very briefly, only from the standpoint of trying to show you how their metaphysic operates. Notice that we are not taking classical Greek examples. We could do that, but you ought to be picking that stuff up from your readings. Notice also that the examples I'm giving are all modern examples, relatively modern. Since the beginning of the modern secular era, since the 18th century. Why is that? Well, once Christianity came on the scene during the Christian era from, well, what, roughly from the time Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire on up to the rise of modern secularism in the 18th century, time of the French Revolution, and so on. During that long period, people were not doing metaphysics in the sense in which we're talking about it. Why? Because they had received Christian revelation, and they received their understanding of the nature of the universe through revelation. And even when the Aristotelian revival took place in the Middle Ages, and even when the Platonic revival took place during the Italian Renaissance, those were subordinated to Christian revelation. It's in the modern secular era that people have been trying to understand the universe by unaided human reason. They have moved revelation to the wings, and they are endeavoring to solve these problems without any benefit of revelation. So that's why my examples are inevitably going to be examples from either ancient Greek times or from the modern secular period. Now, nevertheless, it is necessary to say a few things about ancient philosophical notions, simply to give you a little bit of background. So I'm going to say just a word about some metaphysical concepts of the ancients, and then I'm going to go on to Hegel and to Marx and to the existentialists. The first of the metaphysicians was certainly Plato. And Plato was an idealist, an idealist. Today we think of an idealist as a naive person who is, following his star, this kind of thing. But idealism in Plato simply means that for Plato, ideas are more important than material things. Ideas are more important than material things. And the concept of the ideal is identified with ideas. The most important of these ideas or ideals, the good, the true, and the beautiful. These are the loftiest of all ideas, the good, the true, and the beautiful. The good referring to ethics, the true to epistemology, that is to say what is veridical, and the beautiful to the aesthetic. For Plato, the things you see around you are inadequate approximations of ideas. Your ideal computer for example, your ideal computer, your idea of a computer will only be approximately realized when you obtain even a Mac. If you get a PC, you'll really understand the difference between a lofty idea and reality. yes. Another contrasting metaphysic of the ancient world was that of Democritus. Democritus argued that material things are all important. Democritus was a pre-Socratic philosopher before the time of Socrates who held that the essence of the universe is matter. And it was Democritus who first set forth what we today would call a kind of atomic theory. The automata, the universe consisted of particles. All right? Aristotle, who was Plato's student, didn't take a purely idealistic view of things. He argued that you can only reach the realm of ideas by way of this world, by way of phenomena. It's phenomena in this world that provide you with your access to ideas and ideals. And that's the reason why he was so interested in the material world. Aristotle, was the first one to describe botanical phenomena and so on. And his work in his physics is very important as a starting point for scientific activity. Yeah.
With Plato, did he believe okay that things are just approximations of the real, like in the cave?
Well, he held that they are real, but they are shadows and not and cannot be considered as having the significance of the ideas that lie behind them. Okay, and that's the point of the cave. If you've read the cave. But most of us spend our time, looking at the shadows on the wall instead of seeing the flames and even better, getting out of the cave into the sunlight. And the sunlight and the fire, those represent the ideas.
But he thought that we really could get to the ideas, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Plato was convinced that you could get to the ideas and you could get to them by the intellect alone. Difference between Platonism and Neoplatonism, the later development of Platonism in a mystical direction, is that among the Neoplatonists, they felt that you couldn't reach these ideas solely by intellect. You needed mystical experience added on top of it. Okay, but certainly you could get to these. Concept from the Middle Ages that you ought to know something about to understand metaphysics. In the Middle Ages, there was a controversy between the realists and the nominalists. The realists and the nominalists. The realists took Plato's view that reality rested in ideals or ideas. Okay? The nominalists took the view that ideas or ideals are only names that we give to generalizations. We look at phenomena and we generalize, and that's where the ideas come from, but the reality lies in the phenomena. Okay, now you will come across this sort of classical terminology and these concepts as you deal with modern metaphysics, and that's why I mention them before I go leaping into Hegel. Yes.
So Plato was a realist and an idealist.
Yes, except in the classical period, you didn't use the term realism for that.
But later it would be applied.
That later, and by later we mean in medieval scholastic philosophy. Okay, the late 12th, 13th century, which is the century of Thomas Aquinas. And the 14th century was the great century of the nominalists, by the way. There was a movement in the direction of nominalism in the 14th century. Yes?
Can you summarize one more time what you said the non-realists believe?
A non-realist, yeah, the nominalist. Okay. The nominalist takes the opposite view from that of the realist or idealist. The realist or idealist holds that ideas are fundamental, and what we see in this world is a sort of pale approximation, pale representation of it. The nominalist says that the reality lies in this world, in the phenomena, and when we talk about ideas, we are only giving, we're only talking names or words, because the ideas are generalizations from our experience. Okay? They're nothing more than that. They're just names. They're just words. All right. On to Hegel. Yes. What fun. Hegel is 19th century, and Hegel is to modern metaphysics what Plato was to ancient metaphysics. That is, whenever people think in terms of a great metaphysician of the ancient world, they think of Plato, and when one thinks of a great metaphysician of the modern world, one certainly thinks of Hegel. All right, what was Hegel's position? Well, here I'm going to quote from a modern philosopher, Roger Hancock. And here's what Hegel's position is according to Hancock. Hegel was an absolute idealist, an absolute idealist. His absolute idealism consists of the underlying notion that a plurality of separately existing particulars, uniquely located in space and time, is a false and logically incoherent solution. All right, translating this from English into English, okay? Hegel did not believe that you could build up a knowledge of the world from particulars. It's an incoherent notion that you could do this. What you need is an understanding of the totality of things. According to Hancock, all things shade off into their opposites, and the connections between things that we establish in thought are as much a part of the things as their so-called inherent properties. Hegel was thus led to a monistic position, that is a position that all of reality consists of only one thing. Huh? Hegel was led to a monistic position that there is only one kind of substance and only one truly substantial entity. You ask, well, what's that? What's that? We're dying to know. What is this one entity? It is spirit, the Weltgeist, the world spirit. The world spirit is the only ultimate reality. You can't get at reality by way of particulars. You know, you can see the connection with Plato, or their analogy with Plato, at least. Yes.
So then, would Hegel reject inductive reasoning?
He wouldn't reject it. He would simply say it's not going to take you very far. It's going, you know, it may make it possible for you to invent a better carriage. Or a better piece of kitchen equipment, but it's certainly not going to lead you to an understanding of the universe. Yeah.
What's the basis for saying that? I mean, if a particular can lead you to, on a small scale, greater knowledge, then why couldn't we extrapolate that and say more particulars can lead us to even greater?
He would say because we'll never have a comprehensive enough contact with the facts. There are too many facts to be able to achieve this. We will have such a limited understanding on the basis of our observations that they would never be an adequate foundation for arriving at an understanding of the whole. Mm-hmm. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, you would say, probably also. Yes. Now, of course, you are getting at an extremely important point of criticism. And we'll pick up on you later on this. But that would be Hegel's answer, all right? And Hancock continues, his idealism is an evolutionary pantheism. An evolutionary pantheism. Why? Because the world spirit of reason is a kind of immanent God. Right? God and the world are the same, and this God is moving, this spirit of reason, is moving the universe on to higher and higher levels. Thus, it's evolutionary. Not in the sense of Darwin, but evolutionary in the widest sense of the term. Okay? It's an evolutionary pantheism in which the only self-subsistent reality is spirit, because it is the Weltgeist, the world spirit of reason. Says Hancock, this contrasts not only with materialism, it's the opposite of materialism, surely, but it also contrasts with any metaphysical position associating reality with some kind of hard definiteness. And this is kind of fun. If there's one thing you can't find in Hegel, it's hard definiteness. You know, it's really tough pinning down the Weltgeist. Hard to pin down the world spirit of reason. Do your best, but you will have an almost impossible time pulling it off. And I must also quote, I can find it here, another contemporary philosopher, W.H. Walsh. Hegelianism made a conscious attempt to produce a metaphysics which constitutes an overall reading of experience, an all-over reading of experience. The central concept here is the concept of spirit. It is alleged that everything can be understood in terms of the concept once we take into account the fact that spirit cannot fulfill its potentialities except by working on and against something not itself. The spirit needs resistance, right? And that is the way Hegel deals with the messy aspects of the world. The messy aspects is really the resistance against which the world spirit works to move us onward and upward to that wonderful goal that the spirit has in mind.
Does he ever say what that goal is?
Yes, it is the goal of freedom. Don't ask me to define it. Okay, all right. I mean, in his sense. Thus, we can make sense of the existence of the world of nature in this system. This is how we make sense of the world of nature, the messy aspects of it, as well as the progress. It is there, the messy things are there, to subserve the purposes of the spirit. Yes. And how exactly does the world, what is the mechanism that the world spirit uses? He uses the dialectic. The dialectic. This is the famous or infamous Hegelian dialectic. What's the dialectic? Well, according to Hegel, any idea will spawn its opposite. Okay. And the two will struggle together. And out of them will arise a higher and better idea. The thesis gives rise to the antithesis, and the two of them struggle together, and out of them arises the synthesis. The synthesis then becomes a new thesis. And that higher thesis produces a higher antithesis. And they struggle together. And out of that struggle cometh an even higher synthesis. This is the evolutionary pantheism of the thing, right? Bigger bugs have littler bugs upon their backs to bite them, and littler bugs have littler bugs, and so ad infinitum, we might say. I mean, the thing just goes on and on and on until it ultimately reaches this goal of freedom. Yes. Okay, on to Marx, I hope. What time is this period supposed to end?
7 minutes.
So, anyone can do Marx in 7 minutes. All right. You have this sheet. Didn't we distribute this to you people? Of course, of course, of course. All right. Will you take a look at the diagram on page 2? It has been said, and I believe Marx said it himself, that he turned Hegel on his head. Marx is 19th century, and by this expression, Marx turned Hegel on his head, we mean simply that Marx was a materialist. Instead of seeing the whole universe as explainable by spirit, for Marx, the whole universe is explainable as a materialistic entity. So at the root of all Marxist thinking is a materialistic metaphysic. That means either everything is material, or it means if there's anything that isn't material, it's derivative from the material. Ultimate explanations are going to have to be material explanations. Interestingly enough, Marx did his doctoral dissertation on Democritus, the pre-Socratic materialist. Then Marx applied to this materialist foundation the Hegelian dialectic. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. But what goes into the dialectic here is not ideas, as in Hegel. What goes into the dialectic are material factors. And so out of this comes the concept of class struggle, the haves and the have-nots, those who own the means of production in society and those who don't, struggling, and ultimately a classless society coming out of it. The classless society is the materialistic equivalent of Hegel's ideal of freedom that the world spirit of reason is supposed to be bringing about. This, in other words, is another comprehensive attempt to understand the universe on the basis of reason alone, or on the basis of human thought alone. Again, W.H. Walsh. Materialism can be seen as an attempt to make sense of the world as a whole. That's what metaphysics does. On the basis of a distinctive set of first principles. The primary thought of the materialist might be expressed in the axiom that there is nothing which cannot be satisfactorily explained in natural terms. Belief not merely in the competence, but also in the omnicompetence of natural science is a prominent item in the credo. The materialist sees the world as a vast mechanism. Whatever happens is the result of natural causes, and all other phenomena must be assessed and understood on this basis. Thus, the phenomena that characterize religious and moral life can be taken in psychological and social terms as things whose causes are ultimately natural, though scarcely in terms favored by those who engage in them. Religion, as Freud said, is an illusion, but not an unintelligible illusion. Science can account for it, as it can account for everything else. This is the materialist view of the world. This is the foundation of the Marxist view. Well, I think I am probably going to have to stop. Am I not? It is 1:45 that we're supposed to stop. Oh, 4 minutes. Well, in that case, it's possible to talk about existentialism. All right. Now, here we are going to refer to modern atheistic existentialism. Existentialism began with a lay Lutheran theologian, Soren Kierkegaard, a Danish theologian. But his influence is not at all as great as the modern atheistic existentialists, and they are the ones who have been operating as secular metaphysicians, as it were. The two most important names here, Martin Heidegger, H-E-I-D-E-G-G-E-R, H-E-I-D-E-G-G-E-R, Martin Heidegger, and Jean-Paul Sartre. That's S-A-R-T-R-E, the one German, the other French. Heidegger, yes? Sure. Heidegger, H-E-I-D-E-G-G-E-R, okay? And Sartre is S-A-R-T-R-E. All right. Now, the existentialist explanation of the world is that the only reality lies in the framework of your own existence. Reality lies only within the existence, we would say, the personal existence of the individual. That is to say, there are no absolutes outside of the individual's own encounters with the world. We can't arrive at an objective understanding of the world that will be common to everyone. The existentialists opposed both the Hegelians and the Marxists. Everything depends on our personal interpretation of the world. There are no built-in values. We give the world its values by our own decision-making. Our personal decisions establish value. Example. One of the works of Sartre is a little book entitled Existentialism and Human Emotions in English translation. And in this, Sartre talks about a young fellow who came to him during the time of the Nazi occupation of France in the Second World War. And this young fellow was in the resistance, the résistance. And he wanted to go to England by way of North Africa to fight on the side of De Gaulle. But he had an elderly mother who depended upon him for everything. And he was torn between staying to take care of her and going to fight for free France. And he came to Sartre, and he said, "What am I going to do?" Sartre said, "Decide. There are no omens in the world. And if there were, we would give them their meaning." Okay? Now, the subsequent history of this is not given. I can well imagine the young fellow going off and saying, "Well, that's the last time I ever ask an existentialist for advice." Because I imagine that he already realized he was going to have to make a decision. Huh? But what Sartre was saying to him was that that he couldn't look outside of himself to get any answers. The only answers were already built in, and there are no omens in the world. The world cannot give you your answers. In the case of Heidegger, I will read a quotation from Heidegger's Was ist Metaphysik? What is metaphysics? This is the kind of thing that will ruin your lunch, and that's why I'm going to read it to you at the very end of the period now. What is to be investigated is being only and nothing else, being alone and further nothing, solely being and beyond being nothing. What about this nothing? Does the nothing exist only because of the not, that is, the negation that exists? Or is it the other way around? Does negation and the not exist only because the nothing exists? We assert the nothing is prior to the not and the negation. Where do we seek this nothing? How do we find the nothing? We know the nothing. Anxiety reveals the nothing. Huh? The inner angst, the inner misery of the human condition, we encounter the nothing. That for which and because of which we were anxious was really nothing. Indeed, the nothing itself as such was present. What about this nothing? The nothing itself nothings. There have been people who have become alcoholics as a result. as a result of this sort of thing. And if you think this is any better in the German original, ho, ho, ho. The fact of the matter is that this is asserting, huh, that outside of your own personal view of the world and understanding of it, and outside of your own personal experience, there really isn't anything. Okay? All right. What we've done is to present you with three attempts to understand the world without any reference to Revelation on the basis of reason, in quotes, alone. Now, when we get together next time, we do a little critique of this stuff. We'll see what the problems are and why metaphysics has the problems it does. You probably notice that with existentialism, you are moving very close to what is technically known as solipsism. S-O-L-I-P-S-I-S-M. Solipsism. S-O-L-I-P-S-I-S-M. Solipsism is the view that there isn't any external world. The whole thing is utterly illusory. Showing that there are some serious issues in all this. And as I say, we're going to do a critique of it when we get together next time. See you Monday!